Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Going Old School Show, live on blogtalkradio.com, Wednesday, January 11th, 2023. John, Joe, and John here for you. Chips Crow and Joe, as locals know us. Topics today, obviously, it is Super Wild Card Weekend. Big time, the playoffs have started. 16 teams, 14 teams vying for a spot in the big game. We'll get into that in a bit. We will talk a little later on in the show with New England Patriots historian, Bob Hilbert. He'll join us later on to talk of Patriots history and what's going on with them now. But as we do each and every week at this time, let's bring in a Hall of Fame selector. He covers the Arizona Cardinals for phnx.com. And he also has a co-host of a weekly Hall of Fame radio show on Sirius XM NFL Radio. He is the one and only Howard Balzer. Howard, John, and Joe here for you. Thanks for your time, sir. How are you today?
I am doing well, and I just want to tell you guys that I refuse to bow to the NFL and call this Super Wild Card Weekend. only for this reason. Not that it shouldn't be a super weekend of football, but why do they insult the division winners? I mean, there's six, you know, there's, what are there, 12 teams playing, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
Six of them are division winners, and yet they call it Wild Card Weekend. To me, that's you're insulting the division winners, which they claim is so important to the NFL to win your division, and yet then they highlight the wild card aspect of it. And it's so important to win the division, by the way. Here's a little stat for you that, of course, every home team automatically every division winner automatically gets a home game, which often leads to inequities in the game between the 4 and 5 seed, as it is now, with 7 teams in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And both games this weekend between Jacksonville and the Chargers and the Cowboys and the Bucks have a home team division winner with a worse record than the wild card team. And I'll throw out a little number trivia for you, okay? This way it works out, and I knew it when the league realigned in 2002. So what is that now? 2002 through 20. So that's 21 seasons, mm-hmm. right? When they realigned, I kind of sensed this was going to be an issue because you only had 6 division games that all the teams were playing when it used to be 8. So you went down to 6 division games, and then for a long while, 10 out of division games, and now 11. And so, to me, they diminished the importance of winning a division. And what have we had? Here's my question for you. Counting this year with those 2 games, how many times over all these years do you think there has been a home division winner with a worse record than the wild card team? Just take a wild guess at the number of times that's happened.
I'm going to say 6.
I thought I was going to say 6. Yeah.
Only because of the loaded question, Howard, 12.
How about 27?
Wow.
7 times. There's only been like 3 or 4 years where it hasn't happened. And there's been some years like this year where it's happened twice. And in fact, here's one for you. This is the 5th time that there's been a 4-game differential between the home team division winner and the wild card, where the Cowboys have won 12 and the Buccaneers have won 8. And so out of those 4 previous times, believe it or not, that home team with four fewer victories has won 3 of the 4 games. So anyway, I've always felt that it should be seeded by record. The league claims that, well, no, that's how important it is to win a division, and that's the reward for winning a division. And my you know, my comeback to that is, no, the reward is you're in the playoffs anyway, even if you have an 8-9 record like the Buccaneers. Or 1 year going back a little more in a decade, everyone remembers the Seahawks-Saints game, the beast mode game when Marshawn Lynch had just a crazy touchdown run. That year, the Seahawks won the division with a 7-9 record. A few years ago, a couple years ago, the Washington won the NFC East with a 7-9 record. So to me, the reward is you're in the playoffs, but you shouldn't get a home game. To me, that's the reward, because I haven't looked at this, how many times it's happened, but how many times when a team with only 7 or 8 wins won a division and is in the playoffs and gets a home game, how many teams that didn't win a division but had like 10 wins or more, you know, didn't qualify because of just how many good wild card teams there were. But anyway, that's the way they choose to do it. Everyone has to live with it. But I just thought that would be a little bit of interesting numbers there on how often this has been the case. Now, granted, a lot of those have been 1 or 2 win differences. But, hey, 1 or 2 win differences in the NFL is what separates positions in the standings. Mm-hmm. You get a home game? No, that don't matter. Sorry, that doesn't matter here. Pretty crazy to me. But
how,
so be it.
Howard, that notwithstanding, Howard, I'll get into my Cardinals question for you in a minute, but while you're on the topic of the playoffs, when is the last time you had a Monday night game in the playoffs where the winner is given the gift of having a short week heading into the divisional round, right?
I think last year was the first year they did that. Because that was the creation, because they added a playoff team in each conference.
Okay.
An extra wild card. So by doing that, and let's remember, so last year they reduced the teams that had a bye in the first round from 2 to 1. So that was the only way they could make it work, with 7 teams in the playoffs. One team gets a bye, then you have the other 6. So you've got 6 games. Now, they could have done it with 3 on Saturday and 3 on Sunday, but they just decided, hey, let's have a Monday night game because we have these extra games. And I think they felt like, since Saturday is kind of a different type of day, they like playing the first game a little bit later and then an evening game, and didn't want to play one, you know, relatively early on Saturday. And so that's where they came up with the Monday nighter. And like I said, last year was the first time it happened when the Rams just blew out the Cardinals.
I'm having short-term memory loss here with Howard Balzer. Thank you. Chabala, Joe, I'm going to follow up to start us off, if I may. Howard, we're talking about the Arizona Cardinals hitting the reset button as far as head coach and GM are concerned. Your thoughts on that? And what do you think Mike Bidwell is going to do? Do you have any insight onto how he attempts to remedy this situation with head coach and GM?
Well, the first thing that has to be said is on the front door of the Cardinals' offices, there's a reset button that everyone presses all the time. No, I'm kidding. There's not, but there might as well be, for how many times they press the reset button with coaches. And this is a team that, by the way, a lot of people might not realize, was an original NFL team in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of their years until 1960, they were in Chicago and then moved to St. Louis and then, of course, to the desert. But 103 seasons of NFL football, they've only had 2 coaches last 6 seasons. That's it. Nobody has lasted more than 6. And the story on that GoPHNX that I wrote Monday, it's in the Bidwell's DNA, because Bidwell has been an owner of this team since 1933. It was Michael Bidwell, now the owner's grandfather. Then his father took over Bill, and then Michael several years ago. And their DNA, it's in their DNA. I guess like the Patriot way, this is the Cardinal way, in that they'll have a coach that does well, shows some progress, and then they take a step backward, and they're fired. Happened with Don Coryell, happened with Jim Hanifin, happened with Ken Wisenhunt here in Arizona, and now it's happened with Cliff Kingsbury. Goes from the team won 3 games the year before he was hired. They then won 5, they won 8, they won 11. This year the wheels came off, and a lot of different reasons. We've talked about it all year with the incredible number of injuries and off-field stuff that went on. Bad year, no doubt about it. But instead of saying, hey, I can, as Michael Biddle, I can see why this was all bad. I can't blame the coach when he's shown progress enough, by the way, that he gave him a contract extension after last season through 2027. So that's how much he liked the progress that was being shown and had all the support in the world for Cliff Kingsbury. But back and you're gone and we're reset. You know, we hit the reset button again. I think it's pretty ridiculous. I think that, I mean, you know, obviously someone's going to take this job, but, you know, they've asked permission to speak to Sean Payton. I don't know if that's realistic or not, but Sean Payton's going to come in and say, well, hold it. You know, how do I know I'm not the next one? You know, things right. don't work out in 2 years and I'm gone. Now, a lot of people say, well, you're going to make a lot of money. Well, but that's not the point. Guys want to come to a place where they want to win. They want to win. They want to be successful. And sometimes it's just hard. I mean, heck, the Saints, some years with Drew Brees, you know, guys are going to go in the Hall of Fame. You know, he passed. There were some seasons he passed for 5,000 yards, and the Saints were 7-9 and weren't in the postseason. Did Sean Payton get fired because they took a step back? No. They knew they felt they had a good coach and they'd be able to, you know, get it back and to do the things that you have to do to improve the team. So I don't have a lot of confidence in the way they do things. I know fans don't. And a lot of them thought Kingsbury should be fired, and that's their prerogative to feel that way. But I'll give you one example of a fitting end to this season was that they had so many injured players inactive for the final game of the season on Sunday against the 49ers that they weren't even able to address. They weren't able to dress the number of players that you're allowed to dress, 48. They only had 46. So they played two man short. Not to say that it had anything to do in the game, but it's just the principle that's how injured this team was all year and certainly was in, you know, for this game. I think we talked about it last Wednesday, that they had something like 16 players that either didn't practice or were limited in the Wednesday practice. And that remained pretty much the same through the rest of the week. So what he'll do next, who knows? He says he's going to cast a wide net, which, well, if you're hiring a coach, why wouldn't you? You would think you would. But what he'll end up doing, I think Payton might be a bit of a pipe dream because they're going to have to pay him a ton of money, obviously, and then give up draft picks to the Saints. But I'll tell you guys, I wonder if Sean Payton, and obviously he's going to be interviewed, he'll listen. You know, how much is he using one team as leverage against another team? I don't know where he would really prefer to go. I don't know if any of the teams that are interested in talking to him are teams that he would really prefer to go to at this point. It wouldn't surprise me if he sits out another year. I'm not predicting it, but it wouldn't surprise me. But the big question in my mind and the elephant in the room is Kyler Murray.
Yes.
Is Sean Payton confident that Kyler Murray's style of football is sustainable over time? A guy that's had six injuries in four seasons and five to his legs. Now, I know someone pushed back at me on Twitter and said, well, he coached a short quarterback in Drew Brees. Well, yeah, first of all, Drew Brees was a little taller than Murray, not a lot. But Drew Brees is not a running quarterback. You know, Sean Payton just, you know, coached him into being a great pocket quarterback and made sure to have offensive line to protect him. And they only won when they had good running games. They only won really big when they had a good running game. But the point being is that it's not about coaching a short quarterback. It's coaching a quarterback where his legs are a big part of his game, like Lamar Jackson is with the Ravens. And he hasn't been available now for 2 years in a row at the end of the season because of injury. And so I question whether that's sustainable. And I would think that maybe Sean Payton will. We'll find out in the long run. Of course, if he doesn't get the job, he'll never say that was why. But I think that's a big question, not only him, but for anybody that they hire. Here's a good question. If any of you guys were a first-time head coach, right, you know the landscape of the NFL. You know that if you don't turn it around relatively quickly, you're gone. It's not in 1 year, maybe two, right? And so now are you going to take this job if you don't believe that Kyler Murray's style is sustainable, while also knowing that with a new system put in, he's not even going to be able to practice it because of his knee injury until at least October. So are you diminishing your interested coaches and maybe even interested GMs by having Kyler Murray as your quarterback, who is absolutely tied, you know, tied to the hip with Cliff Kingsbury and Steve Kahn, but Michael Bidwell chose to move away from that? Well, we'll see if it turns out to be the right decision.
You bring up the elephant in the room with Kyler Murray, Howard, and is it even feasible or possible if a guy like Peyton came to the table with the Bidwells and said, hey, I'll come, but I'm not tied to Murray. I want to move and cut somebody else. Is that even feasible?
Not with the salary cap, because he just signed that big extension. And they couldn't do that, I believe, without just getting absolutely ripped asunder in the cap until like 2025, I believe, because I think his cap number for the first 2 years is you know, I'd have to double check. I think it's somewhere around $57 million of dead money if he would leave. And so it just becomes untenable to do that. And so at least, like I said, in the first couple, you know, couple of seasons. So at some point you could move on, but man, you'd have a hard time putting together a roster when you have, and I realize that the cap is going up and it's going up and it's going up, but if you have that much dead money plus just the normal dead money you're going to have, just what happens in the NFL, that's an awful lot of money that you can't use because you decided to move on from this franchise quarterback.
So Howard, you know, JC just asked what is the rumors of what's going on with, they're saying Kyler Murray might have a huge input on the next coach. Is that true, or are they saying anything that Kyler will have any say in that? And, you know, you want to cut ties with him, but it's kind of hard to, even worse with if he has a say in who the next coach is.
First of all, I think Michael Bidwell was ridiculous for saying what he did on Monday, but it's totally been taken out of context and misconstrued and exaggerated. But when you say that you're going to talk to the quarterback, and as he said, I'm going to talk to other leaders on the team to get some input. That's all he said. But then people run with it and put it in headlines. Kyler Murray will have say in who the next coach is. Well, just because you talk to a guy and say, hey, what do you know about this? You know, I don't even know if Kyler Murray even knows any of these coaches in the NFL. Does he know, Shane Steichen, the whatever his name is, the coordinator for the Eagles? Does he know any of these people? Probably not. So I don't know how much input he could have anyway. But I don't think Bidwell should have said that, but he did. And then it was blown out of proportion, put in headlines. Kyler Murray will have input in the, you know, in the coach. And you just used the word huge. I don't know if others have used that, but that was not said. And it's the way of the world. And I think Bidwell sometimes just doesn't think. You know, it's kind of like putting that homework clause that they did in the contract, thinking that it wasn't going to be found out about, right? And then when it was found out about, within 24 hours, maybe a little more than that, maybe 72 hours of the contract being, you know, submitted to the league, it was found out about, became public, and then they took the clause out and actually insulted all of our intelligence by saying they were surprised that it got that much of a reaction. Really? Are you that delusional and that, like, you know, that you don't think that something like that, that you just gave a guy, you have a contract with a quarterback for $230 million and you put a clause in his contract that he has to, like, you know, watch tape a certain number of hours each week, and that comes out that no one's going to react to that? Really? Do you really believe that? I mean, some of the things they do and say, it just makes you, you know, shake your head. He said he was asked Monday whether he considered giving Cliff Kingsbury another year, considering everything that happened, and give him another year to, you know, be able to get a chance of turning it around. And Bidwell never answered the question, but what he did say is we had hope that it would turn around during the season. Well, that's a total delusional feeling if you really thought that way, because you could see what was going on with the team, that they were playing with one starter on the offensive line. They were playing without receivers here and there. They were just decimated by injury, and how you could actually think that all of a sudden you were going to turn it around and make a run like the 49ers did is delusional. And so, but that's what he said. And you just really wonder. And then here's a funny one, guys. I would say at least three times during the press conference, he would constantly go back. I even asked him a question about what I just talked about with Murray. Do you have a concern that there will be coaches, GMs that don't, you know, care for his style, and because it leads to injury? And he said, well, we were 12-2 last year with him and playing some of the best football in the NFL. And I said, well, yeah, when he was healthy. And then his answer was, well, we expect him to get healthy and he'll be great. Well, how do you know he's not going to get hurt again? But the funny part about it was he said 12-2. They didn't even win 12 games all season. They won 11. and their best record was, 10, you know, they were 10-2 at one point. And he said like three or four times 12-2. So what confidence does that give you in a guy who's the owner and president of the team? And you would think he prepared for this press conference, and it's like he's talking off the top of his head and comes up with 12-2, which no one has ever obviously ever said or thought. And we all in the room just kind of looked at each other and said, what's he talking about? Where's he getting that from? So it's just bizarre. It really is. But, you know, it's like that old, what's the old cliche about the sins of the fathers are visited on the sons or something like that? I mean, it's not a great history that the Bidwells have had. This, by the way, in 2023, will be their seventh coach since 2000. I'm sorry, seventh coach since 2000, mm-hmm. and their 11th coach since the Cardinals moved here from St. Louis in 1988. So figure it out. That's an average of a little over 3 years per coach.
Howard Balzer joins us. He's an NFL Hall of Fame selector and covers the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL for PHNX.com. Howard, Cliff Kingsbury obviously may not be a head coach, but just on what you know of him and what you think and your gut, just your opinion, could he be a successful coordinator in this league? Because there's a team south of Boston, not far from here, that really loves coaches that they want to bring in who are getting paid by previous employers. Your thoughts on
yeah.
that?
And you know what? I've thought of that because, A, he has a relationship with Bill Belichick. It was short, but they have a relationship, and they've continued to have some sort of contact over the years since mm-hmm. Kingsbury was there a long time ago. So I don't think that that's out of the question. Now, would Bill Belichick want to play style of offense that Cliff Kingsbury prefers? I don't know.
Right.
Would Mac Jones fit that style of offense? But I wouldn't rule it out by any means. Wouldn't surprise me if Cliff Kingsbury, getting paid a lot of money to walk away, takes a year off. And a lot of people said, well, just go back to college. He has said many times that he prefers the pro game to college and just the relationship with the players and that they're pros and all those things. So it also wouldn't surprise me. He's very close with Sean McVay. And if McVay stays with the Rams, and that's up in the air right now, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he would wind up there, you know, assisting him with the offense, because they are close. They're friends. Kingsbury, I'm not sure if he was in the wedding, but I know he went to Sean McVay's wedding mm-hmm. in the off season. And so that one wouldn't surprise me at all. But, yeah, I think he can be a successful offensive coordinator. He was successful here until, like I said, the wheels came off and Murray would get hurt and not play or get hurt and continue playing while injured. And then they lost offensive line. They lost, you know, DeAndre Hopkins hasn't played very many games the last two seasons. And so that hurt. When he had the full complement of the offensive players around him, last year after seven games, and there was talk of Kyler Murray being an MVP candidate and Cliff Kingsbury being coach of the year. Well, I don't think you all of a sudden, and the people say, well, you regressed. Well, why do you regress? You just didn't all of a sudden forget how to be a quarterback. You know, that word is a crazy one, and even Bidwell used it. Well, you regret. Okay, yeah, they did regress as a team, but why did they regress? Mm-hmm. And he admitted that. He said, you know, we had a lot of things go against us. He said, injury stacked up. He said, we didn't get, we didn't have very many breaks. But then he goes, but it was time for a change. And that, as I maintain, is the Bidwell way.
Howard, you bring up DeAndre Hopkins, and of course, Patriots fans here, he, you know, might be thinking of wanting a trade out of Arizona. One, what's the likelihood of that happening, and what would it take to get him to Foxborough?
Well, first of all, he's making a lot of money, and I don't know that Bill Belichick, I mean, on a, you know, in a 1 or 2 year thing, he could help, you know, turn things around. He's not really a tremendous deep threat. He can get downfield, but he doesn't have great speed, but he's a hell of a receiver. There's no doubt about it, but he's also expensive. I mean, his base salary next year is just a hair under $19.5 million. And he's going to be 31 next June, this coming June. And he's had injuries the last two seasons. So I would think that any potential buyers for him, if in fact the Cardinals put him on the market, are going to have some questions about those things. And, you know, most people believe that Hopkins sees what's ahead. He'd like to get to a team that can win, which I don't blame him, you know, for that. But, you know, all of a sudden, you know, 3 years ago when he was traded, he was only 28 and he hadn't had any injuries. He'd only missed two games in his entire career. Now it's a little different. And then from the Cardinals standpoint, there's the salary cap, you know, hit. You know, some say, well, you can wait till after June 1st to trade him, right? And then you can split his remaining signing bonus over 2 years. But what team wants to trade for a 31-year-old guy who's had injuries, who you can't even get to your program until after June 1st? And the negative for the Cardinals would be until June 1st, while you're going through free agency and trying to upgrade your team, his $30 million cap hit is still on your books until that trade. And so there's a certain amount of impediments to it. I don't think compensation in terms of draft picks would be that high because the contracts drive a lot of deals in the NFL. And when you have a guy on a big contract, then you're not going to give up as much in draft picks. So I don't really know what the Cardinals think. There was a story that was just thrown out there yesterday that to me made no sense, that Michael Bidwell, the first report said he wants to trade DeAndre Hopkins and he's going to tell his GM that. Then it was kind of changed a little bit to say that they would consider doing it. Well, yeah, you consider doing it. You look at it. But first of all, you're not going to tell a GM you're just hiring that you have to trade this guy. And that's just what you want out there in public, even though the owner hasn't said it. If other teams feel that, well, gosh, they're just looking to get rid of him, so we don't have to give very much. Just not a very good way. But I doubt that person who had that had any credible source to the story. So again, I'm not claiming it won't happen, but there's a certain, like I said, there's a certain amount of impediments both for the team getting him and for the Cardinals trading him that could make it difficult.
Howard, would the Cardinals be serious players if Vance Joseph would Vance Joseph make a good head coach with the Cardinals, and are they seriously thinking about getting him as a head coach?
I think he could be. I think he could be. He didn't have a good experience in Denver when he was the head coach there. Again, a first-time guy that's blown out after 2 years. And he didn't have a quarterback now. I mean, he's always said that he likes Kyler Murray, but I don't know if that would be different if he was the head coach. But the one positive would be if Joseph would remain the coach, or not remain, but be named head coach, they have two guys who are considered pretty good young up-and-coming guys by the name, Cam Turner and Spencer Whipple. In fact, Spencer Whipple called the plays in a game against Cleveland. I'm trying to remember if it was 2020 or 20. I think it was 2020 when Kingsbury tested positive for COVID on a Friday, and he couldn't coach in the game. And Spencer Whipple called the plays, and they had a great offensive performance. So those two young guys, if and I'm just presuming that if Joseph likes them and feels that they could handle the promotion, then you have a situation where you can keep the same offense in place. And certainly the two new guys can tweak it and add some of their own little things to it. And who knows, maybe they've done some of that anyway. But you can keep consistency and continuity in the offensive system, and especially in a year where Kyler Murray is not going to be available probably until at least October. So I think that could be a positive thing for them. If they can't get Sean Payton or Jim Harbaugh, then if it's between hiring Vance Joseph and hiring a first-time guy that you have no clue how they're going to be, well, I would say that could be plausible. It could come down to the general manager. How much power is he going to give the general manager? You know, some general managers, if they're going to come in and say, well, hold it, that has to be the head coach? Well, I don't know if I want that job. So there's all these different variables to it that is tough to figure out at this point.
Howard, you talked about Sean McVay, and I just want to ask you a question. The optic of him leaving, it just doesn't sit well with me. Mental health notwithstanding, I'm not sure that's the reason, but he said he needs a break and before he decides what he wants to do. But here's a guy who won a Super Bowl, lost in another, but kind of mortgaged the number one picks and maybe mortgaged the future of this team, at least the immediate future, as far as top-notch draft picks. And that being said, the optic of him maybe kind of bailing on his team is one that I kind of see. Your thoughts on the optic that Sean McVay has if he decides to step down as head coach of the Los Angeles Rams, leaving them, quote-unquote, and I'm saying this, maybe a little high and dry?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question the optics aren't good. And there was credible discussion last year whether he was going to come back and coach last year. And then he decided to and got a big new contract. And Aaron Donald came back. He was considering retirement. And he came back in large part because McVay was back. And then Donald got hurt here. I forget exactly when it was, but he missed a bunch of games coming down the home stretch of the season. So I don't know that it was all Sean McVay in terms of trading all those draft picks. You know, Les Snead was a general manager that did that. And I think a big part of it, guys, was that they ran that organization totally different than when they were in St. Louis. And when they moved to Los Angeles, all of a sudden, you know, they started, you know, spending money and making trades and trading picks for players and signing those guys to big contracts. And the big reason is because they knew they had to be relevant in Los Angeles. And they knew what a difficult market that truly was, even though they always sold it as, oh, we're coming home to this great market with all the tradition. Well, they know how tough it is, and that's why so many of the games there had more fans from the other teams than the Rams, even this year after they'd won the Super Bowl. And so I think that's why they did a lot of those things, because of the way you have to do to compete in Los Angeles. Because I'll tell you, if all of a sudden they had a few of these 5-11, 7-10, whatever records in a row, that stadium might be a ghost town.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they'd be going, Stan Kroenke, the owner, might be going, why do we do this? So, but a lot of that was Les Snead, and it was more an organizational decision than just on Sean McVay. But either way, yeah, that's a bad optic for a guy who has done great things with that team as a coach when he's had the players. They weren't healthy this year. They were to a degree, they were more injured than the Cardinals were. And if you look at some of the end-of-season offensive numbers, their offense was worse than the Cardinals. And so that would put them in a really difficult position if he did walk away, and then if Aaron Donald does. It's almost a rebuild with what they've got going on. So that'll be a very interesting one to see how it plays out. And you would hope that if he is going to walk, that he does it, you know, sooner than later. You know, that would be even a worse optic if he strings them along, you know, for a period of time. So we'll see.
Howard, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you who you like this weekend. Is there an upset that you see happening?
I think there's always potential, you know, upsets. Certainly I wouldn't be surprised with the Buccaneers beating the Cowboys. And, you know, the Cowboys are coming in kind of with this Now, oh my goodness, you know, we won all these games, won 12. We're going on the road. There's all this talk, oh, you got to show your mettle in the playoffs. You know, Dak Prescott, who I think is a good quarterback, also has the penchant for interceptions and mistakes that lead to his team not playing well. So that is one I definitely could see. I don't know if how much Jacksonville over the Chargers would truly be an upset. I mean, they did win, you know, they won only one game fewer than the Chargers. And I saw that they're only like a 2-point underdog. So obviously that's not a big underdog. I could see that. And I could see the Giants, and that line's not that big either. I mean, these two teams played a field goal game about, I don't know, a month ago or so, maybe less, that the Vikings won on a 61-yard field goal. So, but I look at some of these games, and in my mind, if it's a 2 or 3-point line, and even that's the case, I think, pretty close with the Cowboys and the Bucks, I don't know that that's an upset if the underdog wins. There's bigger lines with Miami and Buffalo. It's almost ludicrous to think that the Dolphins, who they announced, by the way, today, if you guys, I assume you saw that Skylar Thompson is going to be the starting quarterback. I don't see how they have a chance at all. In fact, by the way, DeMar Hamlin, there's talk that he might be at that game. I mean, I can't even imagine the emotion that'll be in that stadium if he's there. He went home to Buffalo yesterday to go to the hospital, and then he was released from the hospital today. So I don't know if it would be safe it would be to go to the game. You know, I'm sure he'd be in a luxury suite or something like that inside. But, boy, if he's there and maybe they keep it as a surprise and all of a sudden shine the, you know, a camera or whatever on that box when they're, you know, near the beginning of the game, that would be incredible. But just personnel-wise, I don't see how the Dolphins can hang with the Bills. And the other big line is Seattle and San Francisco. If the Packers had won, this would be that would be a fun game. But Seattle, yes, they know the 49ers very well, but I just don't see how they would have enough, certainly on offense, to be able to score against that 49ers defense. So maybe they can keep it close, but that one would surprise me. So in terms of big upset, I don't really see one, but hey, we've seen crazy things obviously happen in the NFL.
And Howard, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about how's your feelings on this year's Hall of Fame class. I know that they're the best of the best, cream of the crop, but your overall thoughts on this year's Hall of Fame class, as well as possibilities.
It's a very strong group of finalists, and I think it normally is every year. You know, you probably have two first-time finalists that are going to be elected, Joe Thomas and Darrell Revis, and so that leaves only three spots for all the guys coming back that were finalists last year. Some excellent pass rushers, you know, with Jared Allen, third-time finalist, DeMarcus Ware, second-time, and Dwight Freeney, your first. You got the wide receivers, Torrey Holt and Andre Johnson and Reggie Wayne. You know, and I don't have to go through the whole list, but it's just a very, very strong group. And as I often say this, guys, is that take those 15 finalists and you could come up with, I don't know, hundreds of different combinations of five players, and whatever that combination would be, I think you'd have a great class. And I think that's the way it will be again this year. Certainly can't, you know, if those two first-timers get in, which I suspect they will, tough to predict who the other three will be, but it'll be three players that are very deserving. I don't have any doubt about that.
He is an NFL Hall of Fame selector. He's the co-host of a weekly Hall of Fame radio show heard on Sirius XM NFL Radio, and he does cover the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL for PHNX.com. Go PHNX.com. He's Howard Balzer. And Howard, thanks for spending a few extra minutes with us. Always a pleasure, sir. Enjoy your weekend. Enjoy your NFL Super Playoff weekend, if I may say it.
There we go.
Super Playoff weekend. I have to get that out. Howard,
there
thanks
we
a
go.
Lot,
I
man.
Like
I love it, man. Speak to you next week, sir. Have a great one.
Yep. Take care. You too.
Thank you, Howard.
Thanks, Howard.
Thanks,
Howard. Thank you. That's Howard Balzer. Good stuff from Howard. Always a pleasure. And, man, the Bidwell stuff, if you're a Cardinals fan, be scared of your NFL lives, man, because you want to talk about a dysfunctional ownership. Well, that is with the Cardinals. We have a guest on hold. Bob, hang in there for about 1 minute. I want to go to this caller who's one of our P1s, if I may. Let's go to Lou in New Jersey before we get to Bob Hilberg. Lou, what's up, buddy?
Thanks for holding.
How you doing, man?
If I had access to NFL radio, I would listen to Howard's show.
Okay. Dude, he's a football encyclopedia.
Yeah, I'm more of a basketball encyclopedia, but still. Anyway. No, really I am. Basketball is my top sport.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But
we're in the playoffs now, and everybody started to knock Dallas thinking, oh, they're not going to make it and whatnot. Look, I think they can beat the Bucks. Brady isn't what he used to be. And without the Gronk, the Bucks are really nothing. So I wouldn't say it's going to be an easy victory for the Bucks, assuming they win at all.
Look, if the Bucks win, it wouldn't shock me because they're at home, but I don't expect them to make a deep playoff run this year. So we'll see what Tom has left in the tank and see what the team has left down in Tampa Bay.
All right, but you're going to give them home field advantage, I assume, right?
All right, Lou. Lou, we've got a guest on the line. It's going to cut a little short. What's on the show this week, buddy? Tell us.
4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Of course, we're going to discuss the NFL playoffs. We'll also discuss the hirings and firings of the NFL, because it's that time of year. We've got some baseball news coming up. So all this and more Saturday, 4 to 6 p.m. on the Enhanced Sports Show, 512-543-4662. On that note, good night.
All right, Lou, always a pleasure. Thanks for chiming in, buddy. All right, we're going to go from guest to guest to guest here. Next gentleman on our show. He is a public speaker. He is a Patriots historian. He has authored such books as Total Patriots, the definitive encyclopedia of the world-class franchise. Also, Relive Patriots History, a six-time world champions. And he does host a podcast, the Untold Patriots Stories podcast. He's on Twitter at Bob Hyde, H-Y-L-D-B-U-R-G. And he joined us on the show. Bob Hilberg joins us. Bob, John, and Joe here. Thanks for holding. A pleasure, sir. How you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. How you guys doing?
Doing well, Bobby.
Doing well.
All right, Bob, I got to start off. Your event on January 24th with one of my Patriots' favorite players of all time. Tell us about it, who the Hall of Famer is, and where people can go and see and purchase tickets.
Absolutely. Steve Nelson. Patriots Hall of Famer, played from 74 to 87, one of the toughest guys, especially on defense, that you're ever going to see. Averaged almost 10 tackles a game. 1,776 tackles during his career. How patriotic is that? So we're going to do that through the Reuben Chamber of Commerce, Reuben, Massachusetts. You got to buy your tickets through the Reuben Chamber of Commerce. And we're going to do about a 45-minute presentation about his career. We're going to have food and adult beverages. So it's going to be a fun kind of tailgating, networking thing. Sign autographs. We're going to have some prizes to give away. It should be a real fun night. So it's January 24th, Tuesday night from 5:30 to 7:30, maybe 8 o'clock, depending on how many people show up and how much time Steve spends with any of the people that show up. It's on Commerce Way, right off the highway in 93 and 128 and moving about 10 miles north of Boston. So Reuben Chamber of Commerce, get your tickets, and we'll see you at Tuesday night. It'll be a blast. So thanks for that little plug. Steve Nelson, we get some great stories, and he's just a fabulous guy. He's still doing well, even though he's had major surgeries on his hips and knees. But he's hanging in there. His father's 102. We're going to talk about his father as well. So some cool stories about his dad, too.
Sounds like a great event, Bob. And 20 years from now, what are we going to remember this 2022 season of the New England Patriots for?
Two things. One is that lateral is going to come down to one of the dumbest plays in the history of sports. So that Stevenson to Jacoby Myers to, oh, to Chandler Jones, who runs over Mac Jones. Yeah, I mean, if you remember in the day, they used to have the football follies with John Facenda, yep, the voice of God. And you hope that the Patriots weren't on that show because they were so bad in the 70s and 80s. And there was one play, this guy John Tava, who was a running back, he had a play against the Raiders, and he was in about the 15-yard line. He ran left. Nobody there. He started running backwards. He ran right, and he started going backwards. And he ended up at about the half-foot line, and he was just about to get tackled, and he threw the ball over his head out of the end zone, thinking the Patriots would get the ball back at the 20-yard line. And, of course, they didn't. They gave him forward progress at about the 2-foot line. But that was one of the football follies. It's like, oh, man, that's our Patriots. We do everything backwards, and we do everything stupid, and this is going to come back. So John Tomlin is off the hook, and now it's Stevenson to Myers to Chandler Jones. And there's even T-shirts out there of Chandler Jones just running over Mac Jones. So they're going to be talking about that for a long, long time.
Well, Bob, there'll be three things. There'll be the butt fumble, there'll be that lateral, and there'll be Joe Pisarcik. And I hate to say that the Patriots go down in history as one of the three dumbest plays in history.
Absolutely. I mean, that butt fumble, I mean, that's a Patriots. Matt Stevens picks it up and runs it for the touchdown, and Vince Wilfork becomes famous for that. They mentioned that during his Hall of Fame induction this past summer. And the other one is, you know, having two kickoffs return for a touchdown in the same game against the Patriots. So, you know, that'll be something that, you know, some players will think about. I mean, Buffalo would have beat us anyways, but how do you have two kickoff returns against you in the same game? How do you not have a kicker just kick it into the end zone nowadays? But you know, they used to have guys like Dennis Wilgowski and Bob Yates and linemen that would kick the ball because Geno couldn't kick it into the end zone back in the day. Why don't we have guys like that, as Bob LaBelle would say?
Bob Hilberg joins us. He's a public speaker and a Patriots historian. Bob, I want to ask you this because, you know, millennials now don't know. What they only know is about the winning the past 20 years or so. But what burns, grinds my gears is that Bill Parcells is not in the Patriots Hall of Fame. Here is a guy who added instant credibility to a franchise in the early 90s that was ticketed to move to St. Louis at the time. Yet people look at him as bailing on the 1996-97 team. He was out, didn't care about him in the Super Bowl. It's all Parcells' fault that the Green Bay Packers beat them. They hold that grudge against him. But I wanted to know from you, should he be in the Patriots Hall of Fame?
Absolutely. As should Wes Francis and Larry Eisenhower and Julius Adams. I mean, there's some other guys that just put their heart and soul into and just played awesome for us. But, you know, what he did for Kraft, I mean, that's a political thing. I mean, there is a Patriots all-time roster on the third floor where you can review all the history of all the players, interactive computer display, and I put the stats together for all those 1,300 players and over 100 different categories of stats. But the Patriots Hall of Fame, even though it's a fun place to go, there should be more people in there that you want to see the highlights of a Wes Francis or, you know, a guy like that. And Parcells put us on the map. We were horrible. 91, 92, 93. I mean, it reminded me back in the day, you know, I'm 64 years old, you know, when you went to games in the 70s and you didn't go to see the Patriots play. You went to see the other team. You went to see Staubach and O.J. Simpson and the major stars and Terry Bradshaw, because you didn't care if the Patriots win. You didn't think they were going to win, even though we had great players like Stanley Morgan. I know you were talking to Howard earlier about the Hall of Fame. I'm in the committee to try to get Stanley Morgan into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. You know, averaging 19-point-something yards per reception on first down, second down, third down, and even fourth down. You know, forget about it. He was a major star. And he should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But they were running back then, and they didn't really have any playoff teams. They didn't get on TV, and that some of the things that they hold against guys running for the being nominated for the Hall of Fame. You know, we won one playoff game every 10 years, it seems like, until Brady showed up. Really horrible history, but fun history, and there's some diehard fans like myself that have been following him for 30, 40, 50 years. And now we're going to kind of see that for the next 4 or 5 years. We're not going to really be an elite team for a while.
Well, you talk about the Patriots Hall of Fame, two guys who may have played their last game on Sunday in Buffalo, sure to be locked for it, Devin McCourty and Matthew Slater. How will you remember them if that was their last game Sunday?
Yeah, they were more than football players. They were community leaders, spiritual leaders. They really put their best effort. It's amazing how they I mean, even Matthew Slater, how he made the team. I remember being interviewed on a radio station, and when he was a rookie, it was like, what position is he going to play? I mean, they tried him in wide receiver, and one of the obscure stats that I have is, you know, Matthew Slater is the guy, when they kneel, he's the guy in the backfield, you know. If you've ever seen when they kneel at the last 5 seconds, it's like, what position is that? I don't know that that's even a position. Running back. I mean, why do I put him down there? He was on the offensive backfield. But tremendous, tremendous guys. Just gave it all. They put their full effort into it. And the game that they played at the end, I mean, McCourty had, one of his best games in a long, long time. And we just couldn't. I mean, Buffalo was just that much better than us. We didn't really have a chance, but just wonderful guys, and they're going to be wonderful in the community, and pretty emotional when you see David Andrews talking about both those guys, especially Matthew Slater. They bring a lot to the locker room and a lot of leadership, and a lot of these guys, have a foundation of having faith, and that really helps, especially what's going on with, what happened in the last week or two with the DeMar Hamlin and stuff, and seeing the whole country just pray for that guy, and McCourty does it every week with the guys that really come from tough backgrounds and kind of blend in with team effort from all different backgrounds, and faith has a major part of getting these guys through it.
So, Bob, you said, I'm with you. I've been a fan for forever, and I don't see us being at the top of the pinnacle of the pinnacle anytime soon, but so what, if any chance does Stanley Morgan have of getting in the NFL Hall of Fame? How would he get in if he were to get his name on any ballots?
Well, he's made it to the second level, which is the key thing. So once we get into the second, then we got to get him to the third level. So, one of the things that Ron Borges, who's on the committee, he contacted me the 14th year of Andre Tippett's process, and you had 15 years to get in. So it was Kelly Burns of Cold Hard Football Facts and a few other guys and myself. We put together some stats and gave it to Ron, and he used some of those stats in the 15th and final presentation for Andre Tippett, which got him in 2008. So what I did this past year is broke down all 503 of Stanley Morgan's receptions and how it affected the game and what impact it had on the game. Some of it wasn't his fault. He might have caught a pass and got him into field goal range, but then the Patriots weren't that great and they missed a field goal or they got sacked or intercepted or whatever. So I'm open with the breakdown of some of the things that myself and some of the other people on the team put together with Stanley. But it helps certainly when the Patriots are in the playoffs and they're a name out there. So he's got somewhat of a long shot with some of the players out there, but I think he's a better player than some of these guys that have played. He didn't really have the quarterback that Torrey Holt had or Reggie Wayne had, and he still put up huge numbers. So I think that there's a shot in the senior committee. He's got to get it through the senior committee rather than the regular committee, and they're putting two people in every year. So he's got a shot, but now we're in the senior committee, and all we can do is present the facts and have Borges put a presentation together, and there's some politics involved, too.
He's on the podcast. That's the Untold Patriots Stories podcast. We're speaking with Bob Pilbert. Bob, I'm looking at the Relive Patriots History cover, and you have my all-time favorite Patriot. Well, my second one. John Hanna was my all-time favorite. But Steve Grogan, great guy, class guy. I've had the pleasure of meeting him. And, man, people didn't really appreciate him until later on in his career when he was banged up out there with a neck collar on as a quarterback. But he was a real good quarterback, a running quarterback in the mid-70s on some really, really good Patriot teams. And I'll put that 76 Patriot team up against any team in their history as one of the better teams in football. But Steve Grogan, your thoughts on him and what he's meant to that franchise?
Yeah, 16 years. I mean, he loved playing football. So, you know, when he first came here, I mean, he came from Kansas State, and he was a punter, and, they didn't really have a good team, but he was a big, strong kid. And when he came to the Patriots, he didn't know how to read defenses, and half the time, you know, he didn't know where to throw the ball, so he took off and, you know, ran for 12 touchdowns in 1 year instead of wrecking until Cam Newton beat it. But once he learned how to kind of read defenses, and then, you know, in 78, 79, he had Stanley Morgan and Harold Jackson. So, you know, they would just say, you just go long and I'll throw it. And there was one time, you know, I've met Stanley Morgan numerous times. He says, I'm running about three-quarter speed, and I'm about 20 yards from the line of scrimmage, and I see the ball way up in the air. And I was like, man, there's no way I'm going to get that. And he turned on the Jets, and he caught him right on his fingertips about the two-yard line. And he goes back and he says, Grogan, I never thought that I was going to get that. And Steve says, I knew you would. I just threw it as far as I could, and I knew eventually you'd run under it and get it. So they had a ball plan, but unfortunately the thing with Grogan is he threw too many interceptions. I mean, it was a running team back then, but that team was loaded, but they made some mental errors in that game against the Raiders. Cunningham didn't get the first down. Grogan kind of made the wrong call and cost Pete Brock to snap it at the wrong time, so they lost 5 yards. And on third and one, it's third and six. Russ Francis didn't catch the ball. Russ Francis throws an interception. What is Russ Francis throwing in a pass for in a playoff game? So some of those minor things, it makes a difference. And of course, the roughing the passer penalty that you can talk all day about, but the Raiders, you know, we smoked them 48-17 earlier in that season, and I was at that game. That was an incredible game, the only game the Raiders lost that year. We would have won the whole thing because the Steelers were banged up, and we would have won the Super Bowl. But just you got to beat Oakland in Oakland, and they didn't do it.
You know, it's funny, Bob, you mentioned those long bombs from Grogan to Stanley Morgan. And I always used to love as a kid watching Steve Grogan get the defense to jump off sides. Back in the day, they let the play run off as normal, more than they do today, and immediately launch the bomb to Morgan, to Jackson, or whomever. And,
yep.
You know, you look back at those late 70s, early 80s teams, and, you know, I kind of compare them to this team now, and those teams had so much character in them and characters. You know, have we kind of lost some of that with the modern-day team?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're doing with the Untold Patriot Stories podcast is bringing some of those players back. I know we've had a lot of players from the first championship team, and we'll have some more players from these last 10 years or so. But talking to Rick Sanford and Irving Fryer and guys like that, that Maurice Hurst that played in the 80s and 90s, and here are some of their behind-the-scenes stories or stories with Raymond Berry and Bill Parcells. It brings back a lot of memories, and, you know, it was a really tough league back then. I mean, the Colts were loaded, and the Jets were always a huge rivalry, and the Dolphins, and it was rough, tough football. And these guys weren't that big back then, so a lot of fun games to reminisce about and a lot of fun memories.
You know, Bob, I see you bringing the old guys back. Have you ever thought of, like, possibly guys like Tim Fox, Raymond Claiborne, you know, Julius Adams, Bill Linkitis, Pete Brock? The old timers of the 70s, I mean, that was a tough league. That was, I mean, they weren't as good, but they were tough as nails back then.
Oh, yeah, I've met all those guys. I mean, Raven Claiborne, we talked about the Will McDonough incident, and Pete Brock, you know, he caught a six-yard touchdown pass against the Jets, and his nickname was Deep Threat, you know, so they kidded a lot, and, you know. And Tim Fox, we're going to have on soon, but Tim Fox actually was an extra in the movie Everyone's All-American with Dennis Quaid and John Goodman. And there's a scene that he's supposed to be a professional. It's a college game, and Tim Fox said, listen, I know how to hit. I'm a safety, and that's one of the things I like to do is hit people. And so they brought him in. They said, all right, Tim Fox, we want you to hit Dennis Quaid as he's going out of bounds, and we're going to have seven different cameras to get all the angles, and we want this look of anguish on his face because this is the turning point of the movie is that this All-American guy gets hurt, and he ends up with having all kind of matter of problems and booze and all that kind of stuff, and his life goes right down the toilet. So Tim Fox says, all right, you line it up, and I'll hit him. And Tim Fox hit Dennis Quaid so hard that he broke his collarbone. And when you see the close-up of Dennis Quaid's face being in anger and in anguish, it wasn't acting. It was real. He broke his collarbone, and you could see it was like, oh, my God. And they had to stop the production of the movie for 6 weeks and cost millions of dollars because Dennis Quaid couldn't do anything because he had a broken collarbone, all because of Tim Fox. So,
Bobby, final question. Thanks for the time. I got to ask you, outside of Super Bowl 36, tomorrow marks the 37th anniversary of the 8th AFC Championship game, the squish the fish game in Miami, exercised a lot of demons for the Patriots. That is my all-time favorite game outside of Super Bowl 36. Where does that rank with you? And that game, I remember just what I was doing when they won that game to exercise the demons to move on to Super Bowl 20. Your thoughts on where that ranks in the annals of Patriots history as greatest games, in your opinion?
Yeah, I've met a lot of guys on that team, and the whole all of New England and probably all of the country was cheering for us like they were maybe in 2001. We went against the Rams. You had to beat the Jets in the wild card game. Then we had to go across the country and beat the Raiders, which was an amazing game. But mostly the Tupu and Jim Bowman had a couple of special teams and a couple of interceptions. And now we go to Miami, and we hadn't beaten Miami in Miami in 19 years. And Dan Marino and all that. And we just smoked them. We just kind of ran right down them. Hannah had a great game. Lester Williams, defensive tackle people don't remember. Raymond Claiborne had a tremendous game. And it was a rout, 31-14. And when they came back, people just mobbed the airport. And, you know, jambalaya and all that kind of stuff. This place was on fire. You know, with Eddie Elliman, we're off to New Orleans. That was just an amazing time to be a fan. You knew that we weren't really going to have a chance against the Bears. We didn't think we'd get smoked by that, but, you know. But just to make it and win three games in a row, no one ever done that before, and to set the stage. And, you know, the only touchdown we scored was on a fourth down play for Grogan to Irving Fryer for 8 yards for a touchdown, 46-10. But pretty amazing. That was a fun time. And even though we got disappointed and there were some drug issues and all that kind of stuff, but really fun time to be here. And, of course, the Celtics were on fire back then. So that was a pretty good time to be a fan in sports. And, you know, we really don't get crushed that we lost 46-10. We made it to the Super Bowl, which was amazing in itself.
Yep. That was a good old day. Bob, where can people hear the Untold Patriot Stories podcast, sir?
Anywhere. A lot of people are doing it through Spotify, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcast, it's available. Untold Patriot Stories. We've got, I think we're in 11 different countries right now with downloads. We had Rick Sanford on just recently, and Irving Fryer and Bob LaBelle. He had some really cool stories, Upton Bell. So we got some cool guys, and then a lot of guys from the first Super Bowl team, Otis Smith and Ken Walter, the holder and punter. He's got some hilarious stories. So part of this Untold Patriots Stories is to see how these guys overcame obstacles to become better people. So we even have Trenny and Kasmarek from Boston Sportsnet, and Jamie Parker and a couple people that just kind of talk about, you know, the anxiety and the issues of the day and how they overcome certain issues to rise above. We had Greg Bedard on, and Fitzy and Jerry Thornton. So we got a whole mix of different people that talk about how they achieved what they achieved and why they love what they do. So hope you check that out. Untold Patriot Stories.
Sounds great. Patriot historian Bob Hildberg, the stat man, at B-H-Y-L-D-B-U-R-G on Twitter. Bob, my first time talking to you, man. Well, you got to do it again. There's a lot of history I'd like to examine with you and talk about. So we'll do it again, sir. Thank you so much for your time. Have a great weekend, my friend.
I appreciate it, and I want Buffalo to win the whole thing just because they haven't won forever. So,
point.
Pretty
thanks,
interesting
Bob.
For a Patriots fan to say that, but I feel for them, you know.
Good stuff,
thanks
Bob.
Very much. Appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. You got
good
it.
Stuff.
Thanks.
I know you guys had talked to him before. That was Bob Hildberg. Good stuff there by Bobby, man. And that's dumb stuff. I mean, hey, if you're a Patriots fan, just know the history, and we're here to provide some insight. Bob's the guy who seems to know his history, JC.
Oh, there's no question. And there's so much more that it happened, you know, I should say, before the Brady-Belichick era began. And believe me, that was fabulous. But, you know, I look back as a kid, and those Patriot teams in the late 70s, early 80s were just fun teams, you know, and it was good. You can get a seat up in Foxborough. And, you know, I'd like to see some of that get back rather than the, you know, the chaos that we've gone through the last couple of years.
Well, people forget that. People forget up until last year, the year before, Lamar Jackson, they actually broke the single-season record of the New England Patriots that stood the test of time until Lamar came around of the most rushing yards by a football team in the NFL. And it was just broken recently. You know, we did have some history good before 2001.
Right.
And if you look at the 85 team, the 86 team that went to that Super Bowl, they averaged like 4 yards a carry that year. I mean, that was a running team with Craig James and Tony Collins.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, they remind me of this year's defense. Because they created so many turnovers. And you talk about, you know, the woes of the special teams in Buffalo. Well, that year's special teams was so good. I mean, coverage, causing fumbles, you know, they were the epitome of what that team was. Of course, you know, it didn't end well, but, you know, it was fun to – the journey was certainly a fun one.
Well, Keith's right, and it's not sad to say, but it's weird to hear a Patriot fan saying you hope Buffalo wins. Not taking anything away from KC, but it's like, you know, like I said, it reminds me of the 2013 Boston Red Sox where just something's uniting that team, and it just, you know, for that kickoff was 3 years, 3 days, and 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days from the last time they had a kickoff or a touchdown. It was like it's just weird how things are falling into place, and we'll see how it goes in the playoffs because Kansas City's standing in their way, smack dab, and it ought to be fun for the rest of the playoffs. But, you know, it's funny how the whole country will probably be rooting for Buffalo besides Kansas City. Unfortunately, you know, Kansas City's going to be rooting for their team, but, like, the country's going to be rallying around just because of Hamlin, and it's like, you know, things unite states and cities for weird reasons, but, you know.
I do want to go through the two Saturday games with you, John Crow and Joe Ferran, Johnny Centris here on the Going Old School show live on Blog Talk Radio for another 10, 15, 20 minutes at tops. But, guys, JC, I'm going to start with you. It came out today as we kind of, you know, if you don't win all these cesspool, it just overflows. And we're seeing that a few days after the season. And today, I forget who reported it, one of the beat guys for the Pats, but Kraft and Belichick both met, and it looks like that there will be a new offensive coordinator other than Matt Patricia, who's calling plays. A good move, but something that we're going to see, and JC, your thoughts first and foremost on that just being the tip of the iceberg in what could be a really important offseason. But your thoughts today, no surprise really, isn't it?
No, not really. And Tom Curran had on NBC Sports Boston.com. And you know, it was a good and a bad thing because obviously, you know, Belichick has heard the message, you know, whether it was a forceful one from Kraft or whether he fell on the sword and realizes they made a mistake in how they put Matt Patricia and Joe Judge into those positions here. It just didn't work out. But the other part that just makes you think nothing's going to change in the grand scheme of things is the other part of Tom's report is that they're not going to make any announcement. It's just going to happen. And it just makes you think, you know, that it's same old Belichick stuff. And it's going to cost you Gerard Mayo in the process because he's not going to give him the D.C. title. He's going to end up going someplace else when, again, you talk about all these young, talented coaches that you've had on your staff or had in the organization at one time. Kevin O'Connell, Cliff Kingsbury, Gerard Mayo, Josh McDaniels. The list goes on and on and on, and they've all left. And there's one singular reason why. And until that changes, I just feel that they can't get to the next level. I mean, Joe, I mean, I don't know how you feel on this, but it's until you almost have to scrape to the bottom of what Belichick is actually doing and see the root of the problem, there's not much hope of a change, is there?
Doesn't seem like it. Look, I don't want to hear talk. I don't want to hear they had a, I don't want to hear that they had a meeting and agreed upon things. Show me. Show me some facts. Show me some real coaches and give them a title already. Stop with this. It's like, look, I know you're old school. It's all about respect. Well, it's two-way street. And, you know, it goes back to a player talk. How dare we talk back to Bill Belichick? Oh, let's suspend him. Really? Come on. It's like time to own up to, like, times are changing. You're a great coach, but now time to admit that you need help along the way because it takes a village to run a team like that. It takes more than one coach. And start with the special teams coaching. Get a real special teams coach. And then just put a name on them. Put an offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator in place. Just give them the name. Give them the title. As long as his last name is not Belichick, I don't care who the defensive coordinator is. It just better not be a Belichick. It's just, you know, that's just going to cause more problems than help. Gerard Mayo deserves to be defensive coordinator. And I'm with you, JC. You're going to lose him because you refuse to give him a defensive coordinator title. So he can walk away to another team and do the same job he's doing here, but yet get paid for it and have the title. A lot's going to change, a lot.
And, Joe, if I could just follow up on your Belichick point of him being a little petty. How ironic in Buffalo, right, Belichick moves Dick Bailey from injured reserve to suspends him.
Mm-hmm.
Not available. They had the disagreement about whether he should be available or not, whether he's ready or not. And that comes to grind you in the ass because Nick Folk has to do kickoffs. You have Nyheim Hines, two kickoff returns. Folk boots one out of bounds. Mm-hmm. And boom, there your season is gone. And does it go back to trying to get two game checks from Jake Bailey? Is that how far they've fallen? Incredible.
It's true. It's like, you know, you have fallen out with your guy who is doing your kickoffs, who is kicking out of the end zone on a consistent basis. And Nick Folk is steady Eddie, but can't kick off. And it came back to bite you because even the one that went in the end zone that he returned the second one, he was only 2 yards deep. And it was more of a line drive than a high booming kick, so you didn't have the coverage down there. Oh, wait. And he ran through one of your cornerbacks that needs to go as quickly as possible, to go out quicker than yesterday's trash in Miles Bryant, but that's beside the point.
And if you look at the Jack Jones situation too, Jake, JC, on the heels of the Bailey thing, it's apparently got a little vocal or whatever. The kid's a rookie. And to me, when I heard those two stories, I just said to myself, it's pretty evident now that Bill Belichick lost that locker room. I don't know when it happened, but he did.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. And I think he moves that even a further disservice when he comes out and kind of badmouths Mac Jones Monday in the press conference after the season. They ask him, is Mac your quarterback for next year? And he basically says, yeah, he's capable of playing in the NFL, and we just need more production. Man, what a slap in the face to a guy who just 8 months ago you were saying was a leader of this team.
Yep.
That, to me, is malfeasance in every sense of the word. You should be doing just the opposite. You should be building this kid up, trying to mend fences. He is your ticket back to success, not the other way around.
Well, speaking of coming out fighting, he came out fighting when they asked him about free agent class of last year, and he turned around and said, well, you know, we are the third lowest spending team over the last 3 years. We're one of the lowest five teams on spending money, actual spending of money over the last 3 years. And I'm like, they didn't even ask him about spending. They just asked him about the free agent class of last year. And he came out swinging. So he's swinging at everything and anything that's even questioning his ability of what he's doing or how he's doing it. And the question wasn't even on that, but he came out basically and was throwing Kraft under the bus, never mind throwing plays under the bus. So lost his locker room. He lost a lot more than that. So his credibility is hanging in, no offense, but it's hanging in the balance of what you did over the last 20 years. And you need to get it.
Joe Foran, John Crow, Johnny Sungits here on the Going Old School show. And, you know, having said that, looking at Mr. Bob Kraft now, you know, we knew what it was like when he announced to the world that it was spending, opening his wallet, spending some money when he brought in the tight ends just a couple of years ago. And he held a press conference, held court. I'm spending money now for the first time in 20-some-odd years. So we need to win. I get that, Bobby. But, JC, I'll start with you because I think the Patriots right now, talent-wise on the field, are looking up to the Buffalo Bills, obviously. I think they're looking up overall talent-wise to the Miami Dolphins. And I think they're looking up a little bit to the New York Jets. You may maybe can argue that. So Bobby Kraft spent money a couple of years ago, and I know they need to draft well. But they need to open up their wallets if they want to compete with these guys and put that arrow pointing upwards on the free agent market. I think they need to spend a lot of money free agent-wise, and I'm not sure they're going to do that in order to compete for the next couple of years until they get to draft positions and draft capital playing the way they want to be.
And here's your problem. If you're a top-line free agent, and there are no top wide receiver free agent candidates, when Jacoby Myers is ranked number two in free agent wide receivers, there's nothing out there for you. So that dude's going to get a big bag of money because you know Bill's not going to pay a big bag of money for Jacoby Myers, and you need him on this team. But having said that, if you're a top-line free agent, I ask you guys, how much would you have to overspend to get you to go to Foxborough when you have no idea what kind of coach you're going to get when you get there offensively? And two, you have no faith in your quarterback because the coach doesn't have faith in your quarterback. And so, okay, so say you're a guy that arguably is worth $15 to $17 million. What would it take to get you to come to that situation?
A lot, because I got a name for you that was overspent and not worth any penny that we spent. Name is Nelson Aguilar, who we had to pay more money because we weren't that good and people knew it, so we had to overspend to get anybody here. Jonnu Smith had to overspend to get him here. These are two contracts that are just, like, glaring. But you say that, like, we need to spend money. Yes, we do. We wouldn't be in salary cap hell because, wait, we were just talking about the Philadelphia Eagles a couple of years ago being in salary cap hell. How's that work out for them? How'd that work out for the Eagles? They actually now are number one seed. So it's like it's the money you actually spend. Problem is you're going to have to spend more just to get them here because the in-house fighting that's going on, this used to be all winning covers a lot. Winning hides a lot.
Yep.
You don't win. This all comes out, and it's like all this dirty laundry is hung out to dry where winning covered a lot of it up, where it's not getting covered up now, so people are seeing it. Yeah, it's going to cost a pretty penny to get people to want to come to New England.
JC, yeah, you're going to have to overspend. I'm going to answer both parts of the question. How much money to spend to get a free agent and having no faith in the quarterbacks, those two. You're going to need to overspend, number one, because it's not a destination anymore. So you're not going to get a real good veteran who's been around 6-7 years who say, let's go to New England, maybe with a chance, give me a chance to win a Super Bowl. We saw that with number 12 under center, and I get it. It happened a lot. So you're going to need to overspend to get anyone in here. Maybe you'll get a young up-and-comer, but who knows? Yes, you're going to need to overspend because of that destination is not there. And I'll follow it up with a question. Is Bobby Kraft ready to overspend and kind of do that to get the winner on the field? So you have those two forces that are meeting, and which way is it going to go? The tug-of-war between Kraft wanting a product on the field that he can be proud of and to compete and to win playoff games, and to spend that much money to get to that point to win playoff games by bringing people in because it's not a destination. It's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it's great theater in that, you know, you look at just the product. Like how does it look to the eye? You know, just a normal game, just getting in and out of the huddle, making plays. Do you have any faith in your team grinding, you know, down the field, turning the sticks, you know, moving the sticks and just looking competent? And how many times after a Patriots game, win or lose this year, have we said, man, that was a tough look. Man, they had two good drives. But for the rest of that, they really, you know, it was a struggle to get in and out of the huddle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to imagine an NFL team struggling that hard for the little things in there. Like, we're not even talking about, wow, we're like on that mid-tier level, and we just need to get a little bit more talent and be a little bit more creative. This is like, you know, ground-level stuff. It's almost like starting over with guys. And I don't know about you, but even with the money, I mean, we saw him when he picked Henry, Smith, Aguilar. They hit on Judon. You know, Godchild, you know, did well in his second year. But do you really have faith in them this time after what they did last time?
No, I have no faith in what will get Uncle Bobby to spend money, Chips, will you say? What he'll do, when it'll actually hit home and hit hardest, is when you have a home game that's not locally televised because it's not sold out. That'll come soon because these diehard fans out there, the guys, Bob Hellbergs of the world, but these millennials, the spoiled rotten, who have seen nothing but winning since 2000, will get it's all about me attitude, like show me what you're going to do now. So if they can't win within the next couple of years, these millennials, Gen Zs, whatever you want to call them, aren't going to want to spend the money to go watch a game to be at Gillette Stadium because they're going to be like, well, why go? They're not going to win. When's it going to hit home? It's going to hit home when a home game is not locally televised because it's not sold out. It happened in the 70s and 80s. I could see it happening within the next couple of years. I know the season ticket holder list is long, and it's still people waiting. Patience of these younger generation won't be there like the patience of the older generation. And that's when Bob will actually realize he needs to spend money. And they got to draft better. You can get as many free agents as you want, but until you start hitting draft after draft after draft at least 3-4 years in a row, you got no young players. We got old quick, and we're not getting younger quick enough.
Joe, I think it's already started, and I'll get you guys' opinion on this. When they were flexed, when the Raiders game was flexed out of that spot, I guarantee you the ego on Bob Kraft was steaming. So you want to talk about already feeling the effects? He's felt the effects. He saw this team. This team does not have the shine it did, not even close, not even a year ago, but 2 or 3 years ago. They have fallen off the popular map, if you will, not only the NFL. Look at the broadcast teams. They pay attention to all this stuff. They are a not worthy of primetime team right now, and that can only get worse if they don't put a product on the field, JC. I think it's already started with Bob Kraft.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are attractive matchups in next year's schedule. I mean, they have the ninth home game because of the, you know, the 17th game in the odd AFC-NFC. It's the AFC's year. Next year, guaranteed, that ninth game will not be in Foxborough. It'll be in Germany. They'll face somebody, play at 9:30 on a Sunday on the NFL Network. And, you know, we'll continue that. But to me, when you look at, like, Dallas against the Patriots next year, where does that game go? That's going to tell you an awful lot about what the networks think of them right off the bat, many months before they start playing. Because we saw they had faith in this team going in, coming off the playoff game, even though they got routed in Buffalo last year. They had faith in them the second year of Mac. Bill Belichick's back. He's got this team going. He's going to – and then it just didn't happen. So the network's not going to do that again. They're not going to commit to five primetime games for them again. You know, fool me once, shame on me. I mean, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So, yeah, I agree with you both that the train is moving. It can be stopped, but it has to be at the level of what the mentality was in the early 2000s, where the level of excellence and the demand of excellence. I think that's where it's really at, the demand of excellence. You know, I give Tony Mattis a lot of credit on 98.5 The Sports Hub with this line. The old Bill Belichick would have fired the current-day Bill Belichick 4 years ago.
Excellent point.
Because he would have seen this coming. They were always a year ahead, trading Seymour to the Raiders for a draft pick.
Yep.
You know, letting Lawyer Malloy go. Getting Bledsoe out because they had Brady. They were always ahead of things. Now
Logan
it's
Mankins.
Just about – yeah, Logan Mankins, the perfect example, Chips. It's now they're just, what can I do to hang on to my paycheck and break Don Shula's record that nobody cares about? That's pretty sad.
Yep.
Yeah, it is a record nobody cares about. Look, Bill has done a lot of strange things. Look, I've never seen a team – situationally handicapped as bad as the Patriots were this year. They made mistakes in situations where you never timeouts at the end of halves, special teams play, little things that were done to make this team good that everybody said, you know, Bill would hop on saying one or two plays makes a difference. Well, one or two plays does make a difference, but if you're not situationally prepared as this team wasn't this year, they just looked out of place, distorted, and people are taking notice. I know, look, I know they're still kissing his butt and still think he's the greatest, but it's a couple of analysts said, like, early in the year, if they don't play well against a good team defensively, I don't care what they did against these so-so teams, show it against a good team, and they couldn't do it against good teams, and they couldn't keep them together against good teams. Look, Bob Hilberg was right. They were going to lose to Buffalo no matter what because Buffalo is just a better team.
Yep.
Well, until things change, we're not going to be looking. I agree with you, Chips. Look, Miami's a better team. New York Jets are a better team across the board, minus the quarterback, than the New England Patriots. Face it, they've got better wide receivers, better running backs might be even, but they sure as hell have a better defensive line, better linebackers, better cornerbacks than the Patriots ever thought of right now. And they're just Al's pointing up. And it's like, until we get plays in here, young plays, that we don't – we're not going anywhere. We're just falling into the quick
game. And we're up against it, Joe. Guys, always a pleasure, man. Thanks for your time today. Good stuff. Had a quick hour and a half, but when it's quick, it's always fun and exciting. So, JC, Joe, always appreciate your time, man. We'll talk to you really soon, babe.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Have a good night.
That's going to do it for John Crow, for Joe Ferran, Johnny Sunship here, Sonny Hill. Special thanks to Bob Hilberg, Patriots historian, public speaker, and as always, Howard Balzer, who joined us every Wednesday night, and which he will do throughout the playoffs in the NFL season. So until next week, well, maybe get something going this weekend. We'll see, but definitely next Wednesday. But thanks, everyone, for listening. Take care of yourselves. Have a great sports weekend. Be safe. Stay well. Arrivederci. Arrivederci.